Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Emily West, Professor of Communication at the University of Massachusetts Amherst.
Thank you so much, Prof. Emily. It's wonderful to be chatting with you. And what sort of a day is it there? I was speaking to someone in Toronto last week where it had been warmer than it should ever be at this time of year, and they hadn't really had ice.
Same. Yeah, here in Western Massachusetts, it's a sunny day. It's been above freezing for, in the day for at least a couple of weeks, maybe 3 weeks. And yeah, normally I do a lot of chipping of ice from my sidewalk every winter, and I didn't chip ice once. So on the one hand, it's nice not to have to chip ice, but of course, it is a cause for existential worry.
Indeed. This also used to be a way in which lots of middle-aged men had heart attacks during the winter.
Right, yeah, I should talk, we should speak to our doctor friends and nurse friends if we ha have any who work in ERs to see if there's been a noticeable decline in.
It would be interesting to know. And I say it in all seriousness because, pardon me, there are beneficial aspects to climate change, no doubt, in some places. Economically or personally, even as we know that it is a disaster, excuse me, for hundreds of millions and perhaps for all of us. So, Prof, that said, I'm glad you haven't been having to chip too much ice away yourself. Tell us, if you would, what is currently preoccupying, dynamizing, interesting you? What's going on these days for you?
It is actually related to climate change, even though that's not just because we happen to be talking about that just now. I have kids and I really just don't know. We never know what the future is going to be like, but I have this sense of really not knowing what the future is going to be like, what I should what we should be doing to prepare them for this unknown. And then reflecting, I guess, on not just what the things that I do every day, but what I'm doing professionally and what or how perhaps I should be thinking about responding to that more centrally to climate change, as a media scholar. And I know you've been really on the cutting edge of putting that on the agenda for our field, and that's something that I'm really starting to think more about and actually think about building on this Amazon work. That we're going to talk about today in relation to the role that corporations and especially big tech corporations are starting to play in terms of trying to own, I think, this area of emerging area of climate governance. That's where my head's been at.
I'll say, and understandably, before we move on to Amazon, a strange word indeed to be using in this context, of course,
Yes.
could you tell us a little bit about this as a parent? Because I think that's tremendously important. May I ask how old your children are?
They're 9 and 12.
So,
Yeah, so
indeed, this is very relevant for their futures. I have friends in New Orleans who have a 13-year-old, and they're wondering whether the house that they would be leaving her will exist.
no doubt. Yeah, no doubt. I feel like I don't have that quite that urgent a problem. But I do find myself doing things like trying to encourage as many outdoor winter sports as possible with the idea that that won't be an option. Like that they're going to one day look back on that nostalgically as a thing that they did with their parents that you really can't do anymore unless, reliably or safely, or it's just not even a thing, which is actually trivial because that's like a leisure pursuit, not sort of, whether our food systems are still viable, right? So I think it's something I reflect on, but, to be honest, I'm not sure that I really allow myself to think through these things to their logical conclusion, because sometimes, where one goes in your mind can be really frightening.
Indeed, and something similar went through the minds of many parents in the 50s and 60s over nuclear war and
Right, totally.
anxiety about whether or not they should be bringing children into the world. And world hunger was another object of fear for many, even though it was kept at a distance from those in the more comfortable global north. One of the things that often takes a lot of flak from critics of our climate catastrophe is consumption. And that's been one of your major themes for many years, certainly with reference to your wonderful research on Amazon, the company, but also before that, in terms of advertising and promotional culture. So I wondered if you could take us back, as they say in baseball, to what got you interested in promotional culture, advertising, and the whole question of consumption.
The roots of it actually is in my now long ago dissertation research on greeting cards, which was a kind of bringing together this idea of consumption and communication, because greeting cards are like a consumer object, but they're something we use to communicate. And so I think that kind of opened up the whole kind of area of consumer culture. And I definitely take a critical view of consumption and consumer culture, but I also, I think, try to recognize that consumption, on the one hand, is something actually we have to do. There's sort of no consumption option. I mean, I know there's people who are survivalists or go off the grid, but realistically, for the most of us, we're going to be engaged in some kind of consumption. And to really recognize that, I think we can only, I feel I can only go so far in demonizing consumption. Like in my research on greeting cards, I really came to see how people, even though greeting cards, I think, say among academics or people, of a certain class fraction are really frowned upon or, seen as very trivial, I really came to see how so many people really valued greeting cards and like saw it as a very authentic and legitimizing tool. To do something that can feel challenging, which is interpersonal communication, emotional communication, communication that sort of tries to recognize and cement or maintain a relationship that you have. So I think that was a good reminder in that research that there's something about the publicness of consumption, of consumer spaces, that these are, places where community happens. It's a place where you learn about the society around you. You learn about people who are different than you are. And so I really think about consumer spaces and consumer objects as part of our culture. And there's a lot to critique and there's a lot of, critical questions we should ask. But I really think it's important to resist trivializing it. And so in terms of the Amazon project, I mean, when I first started this project, which I think was in 2015, I was kind of amazed how little people in our field had thought about Amazon at that point. And I really thought, I think this is because it's about shopping. People don't think shopping is very serious or important. It's kind of feminized. But of course, Amazon is about so much more than shopping. And actually, how and where we shop, I think, is really important. I mean, I think it's part of how we understand ourselves as selves. It's about, how we move through the world, how we connect with others. So I actually felt that that was very important. And then it was, I think the past work that I'd done about feminized spheres of consumption may have, brought me to some extent to this topic.
Just going back to greeting cards for a moment, if I may. One argument, apart from the gendered one, is that one might view these objects as the democratization of epistolary culture. If you go back to the 18th and 19th century and the habit of the ruling class writing notes to thank people for coming to dinner or coming to afternoon tea or invited people that way to afternoon tea. This was not something that was available to the analphabetic. With capitalism and socialism came, for often congruent reasons, the mass alphabetization of publics, particularly in cities and in towns that had factories. And with that came more writing, more reading. And greeting cards are in part about the industrialization of those commitments, aren't they?
Yeah, and I think part of why so-called educated people maybe look down on greeting cards is this idea that you're going to not use your own words. You're not going to write a letter. You're not going to take a blank card and put things in your own words. And in fact, most cards have pre-printed sentiments, and the kind of the big card manufacturers like Hallmark and American Greetings, it's kind of it's the received wisdom is that it's this, the sentiment is what sells the card. The way it looks and the aesthetics may cause someone to pick it up and take a look, but it's really about pre-printed sentiments. And so I think that I think was one of the, my findings actually in that research is just how important, even though a person is literate, they know how to read and write. It's actually quite high stakes to express yourself around feeling, around recognizing someone else, around kind of commenting on the relationship that you have with that person. That actually kind of is scary for people. And then for some occasions, it's really scary. Sympathy cards, or are a good example. And so it's very comforting, and it gives people that sense of certainty. And I think recognition when they go to the card section and they see a card for the occasion that they're looking for, and they recognize themselves in that relationship. That was came across so powerfully in interviews I did, and I think it comes across too when people complain and feel very hurt when their occasion is not recognized. When they can't find a card that's suitable for sending to a family member who's incarcerated, when they can't find a card that's suitable to send for someone who had a miscarriage, when they can't find a card that reflects their cultural experience or that's, uses their language, for example. They have a sense of being excluded from commercial culture. So being recognized and included in mainstream commercial culture really matters, and I think is a marker of like full citizenship for people. And greeting cards were sort of a way to see that. And of course, we see that play out all over in media, right? Like if you don't see yourself in mainstream TV shows or in films, there is a kind of symbolic harm there that people experience.
And speaking of seeing yourself in places, that does get us to Amazon. You were saying that for years it seemed as though academics were not paying much attention. I do remember quite a lot of university presses being rather pleased that Amazon at one point was buying at least one copy of almost every book when it was physically retailing lots of these things, as opposed to electronically doing so. And when you got interested, how did you get interested? And has academia caught up?
Well, I'll answer the second question first. I think academia is definitely caught up. There's really great work being done about Amazon. In fact, there's this collection that I have behind me, Amazon at the Intersection of Culture and Capital, and you have a chapter in it, as do I. And there's great work going on about, what's happening in the fulfillment centers and about like gig workers, like on Amazon Mechanical Turk, and delivery workers, and the role that, the way that Amazon is structuring cities, and work on third-party sellers, and how, Amazon has, I'll just mention Moira Weagle. She did a great report for Data and Society based on a lot of interviews with third-party sellers, like small businesses. There's been a huge acceleration in Amazon studies, and I'm really happy to see that. And when I but yeah, I'll tell you a little bit about when the light bulb went off, essentially.
A light bulb delivered to your home by.
the metaphorical light bulb in this particular case. Yeah, I was just reading, New York Times headlines, and I saw this article about working conditions at Amazon, but ac it actually focused primarily on working conditions in Seattle at headquarters among white collar workers, among software engineers, marketing executives, things like that, and just how like there was this sense, and I think there maybe still is, that tech work is fun and it's loose and groovy. And this article was about how this is just definitely not the case at Amazon, and that that there were the productivity protocols and things that they were doing, even at headquarters, were basically like psychologically and emotionally abusive. That they talked to people who had quit, or some people who were even still working there, about how there was just, you're expected to work all the time, long hours, weekends, no understanding about illness or illness in your family, regular things like, report who you think is the weakest member of your team, because maybe they're going to be fired. I mean, just people crying at their desks constantly, stuff like that. And but I think the broader theme of the article was just how little we think about, and how little we know about what it takes to get us these products in, 2 business days, which was the prime shipping promise at the time. And it also mentioned, some of the reporting that had already been done on the fulfillment centers, the warehouses, and how dangerous, and how, the kind of the extremes for achieving productivity that Amazon was doing at the time. So I think that a light bulb went off, because it made me really think about, well, this is tech changing, a huge part of our lives, how we get stuff, shopping, also increasingly how we access books and entertainment. And I had really not thought about Amazon. Amazon had just blended into the furniture for me, like it has for so many people. And I thought about just how incrementally I had was interacting with Amazon more and more over the years, how I got sucked into the membership, how probably in like the year 2000, I might have bought 1 or 2 books a year there. And then, now I was a Prime member, and I was watching shows, and I was, probably buying more and more, especially after I'd had kids, just having that sense of like, oh, getting things delivered is such a lifesaver. So I think it was really kind of a personal response, seeing that not just as a bit of a blind spot in our field, but feeling it had been a personal blind spot, and how deeply ironic it was, given that I was someone who studied media and consumer culture, so I just lent into that irony, and I wrote this book, which I think, because there hadn't been a ton of stuff on Amazon, it really takes a bit of a bird's eye view, and like tries to think about Amazon as a brand, and what that relationship is, how Amazon as a brand has, how it's cultivated itself as a brand, how that brand works differently maybe than other types of big brands that we would think about, and how that relationship that it has with its users, how its image has helped enable it to become the monopoly really that it is, and to become as ubiquitous as it is, and to try and draw attention to that with the hope that it helps us find ways to question and resist it.
And this is your book called Buy Now.
Yes, Buy Now: How Amazon Branded Convenience and Normalized Monopoly.
I'm glad you remember its title. I recently interviewed somebody who couldn't remember her job title, and I felt like laughing, and then I realized I couldn't remember mine.
I do
So,
have the book right in front of me, just in case.
well, with when I asked you, when I said, asked you to say your name, with some guys in particular of my age, I recommend that they either write their names down in order to know what to say, or hover their computer screen, hover the integer over their computer screen in order to be able to read their name if their name indeed appears. This, I think, is very important, what you've done. It's a fantastic book. And
Thank you.
in addition, one of the problems I think that your wonderful origin story about reading the New York Times tells us is a problem with a lot of the positive and negative accounts of consumption. As you rightly imply, ever since Kant, really, consumption is attacked in a very gendered way. But one of the things about consumption, both in when it is attacked and when it is defended or even celebrated, is that insufficiently people go back to Marx and what the old man had to say about the problem of the fetish. Not in the Freudian sense that that might apply, but in the sense of an object that loses its material conditions of existence in its shininess. its beauty, its power, its affordability or availability, whatever it might be, and how so much of the study of culture has missed a step, I think, in not tracking the material life of the sign, including logistics. So I think it's a fantastic contribution. All of that said, I'm an Amazon Prime member. I have been, I don't know, since before, well before your children were born, almost probably before you were born.
No.
I enjoy Prime Video. During the first two big waves of the pandemic of COVID-19, for 2 years I was living in Mexico, where the death numbers were utterly extraordinary in percentage terms. 20% of my students lost a parent.
Oh
My
my
students
gosh.
were generally living in a family of nine people in a three-bedroom place. They were buying oxygen on the street in order to survive, speaking to me online while teaching with oxygen tanks to keep breathing. And I certainly relied on Amazon to bring me lots of things. And so I am part of the problem at the same time as I'm always loath to reach for the lever that you pull in order to attack consumption. And this gets back to something very valuable for me that you said earlier, and I will shut up in a minute because this is about your work, not about my opinions. When you said that we all have to consume, because under capitalism and living in cities and disarticulated from subsistence, we do. And I wondered if you could just elaborate a bit upon what the responsible customer should do about Amazon. Do you have any ideas about, can we drag Jeff back to the office from outer space to save?
Well, I want to just acknowledge, as you are, I am a Prime member. I may, maintain my membership while writing this book. Because I wanted to see how Prime worked and the relationship that it built with customers. And I still haven't canceled it, in part because of Prime Video. I really have cut back on how much I buy and tried to like disrupt that sense of, automatically that's where I'm going to buy stuff. But I still do e-commerce, and I actually, as you with your, description of living in Mexico in the pandemic, I mean, I think that the cat is out of the bag with e-commerce. Like, e-commerce is here to stay. And there are actually really good things about e-commerce. If you think about, people who have health or mobility issues or time issues that, prevent them from being able to, access goods, then, it's not just convenient. It can be something that is really impacts people's, positively people's quality of life. Maybe evens out like urban versus rural, divides. I mean, I think there's a lot of potential. And there's, one of the things I look briefly at in the book is there's some research that suggests that if you organize e-commerce, well, that actually the climate impacts can be less. Because if you think about individuals in cars all driving to the same store and then driving home, if you just had a delivery van that went out and did a, a well thought out route, that would actually be a reduced climate impact. So there's ways for us to think about doing e-commerce better. And so when I think about, I really admire people who have cut the cord with Amazon, and I think sometimes there may be an element of privilege and being able to have the time to only shop, at local purveyors and things like that. But nevertheless, I definitely take my hat off to people doing that. I do have some skepticism that a consumer boycott is sort of the best way to respond to Amazon. And I have a variety of reasons for that. I mean, one is just like real, how realistic is this? Like, Amazon is basically essential infrastructure for commerce and communication now. Like, Amazon's fingers are in so many pies. You're using Amazon when you don't even realize it, type thing. And also, a lot of Amazon is the second largest private employer in the United States. And it's been, a lot of small and medium-sized businesses now depend on Amazon to distribute and market their products. So I think we want to think carefully about, whether a boycott helps or hurts people in those situations who I think are dependent on Amazon in a variety of ways. So what I really call for is like thinking about what consumer politics looks like in this age of tech monopoly. And this is in an American context where consumer politics is just not as strong as even it used to be, many decades ago, and I think not as strong as it probably is in other national contexts. But I think it's, in this sort of antitrust moment that we're starting to see emerge, I really think that it's important for consumers to be more visible and vocal and involved in that, and to really understand how it's shaping our rights or even our scope for agency as consumers and citizens to be so beholden and dependent on these tech monopolies, and to be involved in the conversation about what it would mean to put more reasonable constraints on these on tech monopolies like Amazon. I think we're in a kind of nascent moment with that here in the United States. I think other regions, especially the EU, are farther along. I think maybe Australia and Canada are other places that are farther along in thinking about this. And so we can learn, I think, from what other places around the world are doing. But we also need to think about what does it mean to be like a tech consumer? Like, we never get together, we don't see each other at the Amazon store typically. And these things are so ubiquitous in our lives. What would it mean to really get tech-focused, monopoly-focused consumer politics going?
And of course, also to identify ourselves not only as consumers, but as workers who may have things in common with the people who make Amazon tick. Now, Prof. W., your book is dedicated to your grandfather, who loved to go shopping. Would you mind my asking a little bit about him, particularly because I'm assuming he may have had Welsh heritage if his name was Selwyn?
Yeah, so my grandfather's name was Selwyn John. I mean, he was Welsh. He lived in Swansea in South Wales. And I guess most of my memories are of him are after my grandmother died. So I'm not sure if he had always been someone who loved going to the shops, but for the last whatever 16 years of his life, he was responsible for provisioning the home. And I think he was a little bit of a slightly isolated person, but he loved people. He loved being in public. He loved a sense of community and place. And he loved going to Marks and Spencer's, which British people will recognize, and picking out like the most beautiful produce, and or Sainsbury's, and just being in town and seeing people. So yeah, I think of the sort of routine provisioning, whether he was driving or then eventually taking the bus to go to the shops as a such an important part of his daily life, and a way that he felt connected to where he lived and to his community, even if he wasn't, through, other ways
I'm
otherwise.
lucky, Prof. W., in that I live in a region where I can walk to fruiterers, to greengrocers that
Nice.
are independently provisioned, and where you get a brown paper bag with nothing on it that's curled up once the food's put inside it. And you know the market where the fruiterers bought their stuff. It's quite a different experience, but it's an experience where I see a lot of older people spending time to natter with the fruiterers, to have human interaction in a way that simply can't happen in corporate entities. When you go to the dentist or the doctor or the supermarket, this cannot happen. No time can be allowed. But in these small businesses, that possibility for phatic communication on the part of the elderly still exists. So I really appreciate A, you're dedicating it to Selwyn, and B, you're telling the story. Now, Prof, one of the things that you write about in the book, and I think you've done this elsewhere too, is surveillance. When I taught in the United States for well over 2 decades, students were very exercised, as were the bourgeois media, by the idea of surveillance, and it meant the state. Nowadays, people are much more concerned about corporate surveillance, it seems to me, with Amazon as one of the major entities, along with various other companies like Meta and Calendar. You have a partial defense of this sort of consumer surveillance, or an explanation that it's multifaceted, I think. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I don't know if I think of it as a defense.
An
I think maybe I just have
explanation.
a slightly different take, maybe, because I think there's a sense that, well, often when you read about this critical work on surveillance, there's a sense that it's obscured, that we have no idea, and that it's definitely always going to be unwelcome. But what I see with Amazon, and especially with Alexa, is surveillance being offered fairly explicitly, like, yes, we're watching you, we're listening to you. I mean, even before Alexa came along, Amazon, was an early adopter of things like, of behavioral targeting, essentially, of using your clicks, what you bought, even what you looked at, to, shape what what they then were going to recommend to you, or what the homepage was going to look like. And it was often the thing that they would say, like, we do this, like, this is good. You should have a different Amazon store than, your neighbor or your friend, because, we're going to have 4.5 million Amazon customers, back in the 90s. We're going to have 4.5 million storefronts. And then with Alexa, that's really supercharged. So that's allowed Amazon to go from the doorstep into the home, and be a kind of always on listening device. And I, in looking at these various services that Alexa offers, or even kind of a variety of different services like that, just make things really convenient, that allow Amazon to drop things off in your in inside your home, or what have you, like using the Ring doorbell or doorknob. They're offering surveillance as a form of care, and I actually think, if you think about care and intimacy, part of it is that, the other person is really noticing you, and recognizing you, and then reflecting that back to you. So it seems almost perverse for that to have a relationship like that with a brand. But I do think that that's what Amazon has been doing, and I think really successfully. There's even a marketing agency in New York, I think, that focuses on brand intimacy, and they've said that Amazon is the most intimate brand, and I believe it. Like when you interact with Amazon for so many different things, when you have like a interpersonal relationship almost with Alexa, if you subscribe to that service, if you're using multiple smart home products that are organized by Amazon, then, and if Amazon has come to know so much about you by listening to you, not just like what you say, but your tone of voice, noticing when and what you watch on Prime Video, or what and when you stream on Prime Music, or what you read, and like what pages you spend more time on, and what pages you go faster on. I mean, it gets to a point where, like, that combination of data that they have about us is really, with the help of machine learning, can come up with some really, profound insights. So I think it's more an explanation, I think, of why people consent to allow Amazon to have to be, to have such an intimate relationship with them, because I think they genuinely experience it as a form of care. That's how it's being offered to them. People, I think, often feel quite affectionate towards Alexa, and when someone anticipates your needs, or like, as I think increasingly Alexa and Amazon is trying to do, or at least, responds to the things that you ask of it, it builds a tremendous amount of intimacy and trust. So, yeah, that's my take on surveillance. Is like it's offered as a service, right? Amazon is a service brand, and so part of that is it offers surveillance as a service, and as a tool to make that service ever more intimate and personalized and anticipatory.
One of the things you write about in the book, before talking about the desire to see consumers organized, is the attempt by Amazon workers in the United States to organize and the kind of obstacles that they confront in this. That, guess what? Amazon doesn't like unions. Now,
Nope.
if you go back 60 years, Big corporations, wealthy corporations in the United States, take GM, General Motors, or Ford, quite like unions because they provided dependability. Hollywood studios liked unions, and to some extent still do, because they took healthcare off their hands. They organized healthcare on behalf of these corporations, a big bureaucratic hassle and difficulty. What is Amazon's problem with workers organizing?
I think that they actually do have some problems with the dependability that you're talking about, but they want to be in control of the solution. And they do not want to share power as would be required with unions. So they are trying to address, because the in terms of the dependability issue, so basically warehouse work is really hard and people generally don't like it, is my understanding. So the turnover in these fulfillment centers is really high. I think in some fulfillment centers it's more than 100%, right? Which means that they've had people come in, leave, and then other people have come to replace them within a year. I mean, not every single person, but in terms of the average rate of turnover. So there's huge costs to that in terms of, and we could talk about why it is that it's not a very appealing job, but there's huge costs to Amazon with that, obviously, training and, inefficiency and, all this type of thing. So they are doing things actually to try to make warehouse work more appealing. And so, for example, they did go to a $15 an hour minimum, which I think is whether that's good or not, I think is really up for debate. But I think, in general, they've been paying more and more, even above 15. They've, they have pretty good benefits, I think, relative to other types of kind of wage work. They offer, this is going to be shocking to people outside the United States. They offer like 20 weeks of parental leave, which is like really unusual. Again, for waged work, sometimes there's no parental leave really guaranteed at all. They have a lot of career training. So they're trying to do all these things, I think, to address some of the issues with labor that they are experiencing, that they're only going to experience more and more as time goes on, as people have kind of cycled through and said, no, I don't want to do that. And it might make sense, right, to have a union sort of be, on behalf of the workers, and then the workers would feel that someone genuinely has their back, and then maybe working conditions would actually be made better. But I just think Amazon does not want to share power, right? They have a close eye on that bottom line in terms of productivity. Their number one leadership principle has been since like day one, customer obsession. And a few years ago, they ad added attempt to be Earth's greatest employer as like their 20th leadership principle or something. So they are, I think they recognize that people think Amazon's not a good employer and that's a problem for them because they need to hire a ton of people. But in the end, customer obsession is always going to be number one. And they do not want a power share with a union that might compromise their vision of,
What
being a
that
customer
means.
obsessed company.
But I guess one of the things about US capitalism is that so often it's actually, apart from the fictive capital world of hedge funds and so on, when it comes to companies that actually make or distribute things, their obsession is power, just as much as money when it comes to workers. This is and you can see it nowhere better evident, I think, than in popular US team sports, which, by contrast with sports like association football, allow for almost soccer, zero autonomy on the part of the players, the athletes. So I wondered if we could jump into sports briefly, because that's another area about which you've written.
Well, I've read about cheerleading.
That's a
Yes.
sport.
Well, actually,
Or is it? No,
so
no.
Laura Grindstaff and I wrote a piece,
Yes.
I think the year was 2004 or seven. It's quite a while ago now. And actually, we're going to be revisiting it this year for an edited volume. But it was about the sport debate in cheerleading. Essentially, cheerleading, which used to be well, it's got a longer history, but let's say mid-20th century, it was this feminized, supportive activity that had some athleticism, but was really about the performance of feminized support for male athletes. That really started to evolve in the later part of the 20th century into a much more athletic activity. This is both in the high school level, especially at the college level, and then it spun out essentially into being so athleticized that there started to be cheerleading competitions that and if you've never watched a cheerleading competition, the athleticism is really remarkable. The tumbling, the stunting, throwing people up in the air who do multiple spins, etc. So that sounds like a sport, right? If there's competitions and there's tremendous athleticism. But especially in the high school and college world, there's been a desire to say yes, cheerleaders are athletes, but no, it's not a sport, because as soon as you call it a sport, it becomes much more regulated, and organizations like the NCAA, which is a kind of national college regulatory organization here in the United States, get involved and start to have oversight over things like how many hours a week are you in practices or games? Closer attention to things like how many injuries there are and what happens. And this was something that cheerleading programs don't really want to be subject to, because often, in order to be supported by their schools, they are both cheering on the sidelines at games and going off and doing their own competitions. And they often are like vastly exceeding what might be limits on hours and things like that. And so there's been a way in which the legacy of it as the supportive activity has been really held onto by most institutions. And so it's in this liminal space of like, yes, it's athletic. We really admire this athleticism. There's going to be competitions. There might be prizes. There might even be scholarships. But we're not going to say it's a sport, because that opens this regulatory can of worms.
I remember there was a time when the big wrestling pro sports, so-called, in the northeast of the US were based in New Jersey, because New Jersey state law defined wrestling, not college, not athletic wrestling, but WWE, WWF, these other entities, as entertainment, not sports, which meant that the organizers didn't have to hire doctors and other medical staff to be present. Which would
Yeah,
have been the
that's.
case had they been based in New York. That's a fascinating story, and Laura Grindstaff's work, both with you and separately, is wonderful. So, Prof, I've got two more questions for you, if I may, and then I'd like to throw over to you for you to add anything you wish. Does that sound all right?
That sounds great.
So, the first question is, I'm 24, I'm an eager beaver, recent grad, I've done my master's, or I'm in it. I knock on your office door and I say, Prof West, I really love your work. I want to be like you. What do I have to do for my doctorate to become like you? What do you say?
Well, wouldn't that be flattering? I guess my hope would be, that I'm not interested in creating clones. And I think, the work that we do in critical media studies really needs to change with the times. So I would more just want to support that, and media is changing so rapidly. I mean, even though I think some things actually, it's really important to understand history and theory of media, not to overstate that sense of the terror of the new, and that everything is new. But nevertheless, media is undergoing tremendous changes. And so, I would be interested in supporting someone who wants to start their doctorate, obviously to find a good program, that's going to allow them to fulfill their goals. But to, be in a program that allows them to draw on their own observations and experiences, and to be able to be nimble and respond to the urgent questions that arise, as opposed to kind of being asked to like fit a certain pre-given expectation around what you should study or what it should look like. So yeah, I mean, I work with a lot of PhD students, and I really enjoy learning from them, learning things about what media is and what it does that I'm not in a position to understand or know about. Like right now, I'm working with a student who's looking at the role that digital platforms are playing in reshaping space and community in rural China. Like how, what chance do I have to know about that other than really through her work? So I think in terms of like where things are going, I mean, I think being in that position to be responsive to the urgent social questions that arise and political questions and economic questions that arise around media and a training that will allow you to do that is important. But I also think maybe I would want to mentor students now to do something that I think I maybe haven't done as well as I would like to, this podcast notwithstanding, which is to simultaneously understand how to contribute to the field of communication, how to be in a position to shape scholarship and teaching, but also how to reach broader publics, which I think. I think you're really good at that. I think that's something that we should be, that we are, like in our department, but something that I wasn't necessarily trained in from early on, and that I think it's really important for, say, this 24-year-old now to be thinking about from the very beginning.
Wow. So, Prof. Emily, my last question before handing to you is to ask you about how you find out the things you find out. How did you learn all this stuff about consumer culture, about Amazon, about cheerleading, and so on?
Well, I'm really a qualitative researcher, and I think it's great to have different methods in your toolbox. Some of the research I've done has been like the cheerleading research. There was a lot of participant observation suggests I was cheerleading, and I would say I wasn't, but a lot of observation, a lot of hanging out, as well as interviews. So a more ethnographic approach for that project. The greeting card research I did was a combination of field work and a lot of interviews. And I really enjoy interview-based research. And actually the Amazon project I was less ethnographic than work I've done in the past. So in part I think because it was sort of an untapped project at the time that I started it, I just felt like there was so much low-hanging fruit and there's so much written, there's so much data just like out there to kind of come through and make sense of that. It was a little bit more of a desk research project in terms of news, trade press, just looking at the Amazon site and its own marketing and the way it presents its services and how that's changed over time, like judicious use of the Internet Archive, like the Wayback Machine, for example. And I actually did do some field work as well in terms of just visiting public facing, like looking at how Amazon presents itself to consumers in physical spaces, which at the time was some of its brick and mortar co store concepts, as well as the fulfillment center public tours that it had. So I was able to go on some of those. So that's, some of the methods. I guess that's, it's really, I heard that question as being about methods. I'm not sure if that's what you meant. But in work going forward, I think I'm getting more and more interested in policy and in kind of the self-regulation that platforms are doing around issues of climate and kind of creating their own accountability organizations and areas of investment in climate tech. So I think I'm getting maybe in the next phase of research, I'm going to be looking more issues of policy and I guess a bit more the business world. I've been focused more, I guess, on consumers and users, and now I'm getting interested in what's happening on the business end.
And Prof. Emily, is there anything you'd like to add to what we've discussed?
We've covered so many things. I don't know. I I guess I would just say I'm really excited to see all the other work that people are, I know are doing right now, and see the work that's coming out on Amazon, and I think and on platforms more generally. So I think it's just a, I would just add that it's a real moment, maybe past due moment for us to be trying to understand what platform power is, and how, where it's going, and what our responses to it should be. So it's just my hope to be part of a community of people trying to figure that out and raise awareness about it, from the location that we have, which is, the Media Studies Academy and the tools that we have in it.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Professor Emily West. It was great speaking to you. I love your work and I loved chatting.
This was wonderful. Thank you, Professor Toby Miller. I've really enjoyed your work, lo these many years, and it's been a real honor to talk to you.